Welcome to the Focus Today podcast with Perry Atkinson.
Well, welcome to Focus Today. I'm your host, Perry Atkinson, and I am really looking forward to our guest today. And I'm so honored to have with us Michael Bridgent. He is a former intelligence officer, current senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, specializing in all kinds of things, lethal aid and terrorist groups. He has served for over 28 years of experience working in security, terrorism, counterinsurgency, and policy issues in the Middle East, in North Africa, and Southwest Asia. He does have a website. You can go to Hudson.org. That's the website of the Institute, Hudson.org, and check out a lot there. Michael, I was reading your bio. Wow. Thank you for your time. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Where are you? Where are we Skyping you in from?
Washington, D.C.
Okay. Thank you. Boy, a lot to talk to you about. Let me just kind of dive into it. President Biden, during his State of the Union address, he opens up with Ukraine. What was your take on that so early into the speech?
Well, you know, I joined the military when there was a USSR, so I am all about, you know, stopping Putin with what he's doing. You know, the issue with Ukraine is there is a lot of corruption there, so we have to look at that. We also have to weigh that against what Putin's doing, because the only way you could be effective in a country like the Ukraine, and I've seen this in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan, is a healthy level of corruption. And I know that sounds terrible, but the only way to get people to do very difficult things is to make sure that they are paid and stay in power. And absent the rule of law, absent a constitution, good people don't keep their positions. So we have to look at the Ukraine through that lens. The one thing that I would like the Biden administration to do is actually give the Ukrainians an offensive capability to be able to take back territory. I think the Biden policy so far is to give Putin enough of a win into Ukraine in order for him to off-ramp. And that's why we haven't seen the administration give them a lethal offensive capability to take back territory.
Wow. So what's the 30,000-foot view? Where's this thing going?
Well, it looks like a stalemate right now, right?
Yeah.
It looks like a stalemate. If we have a new president in office, that may change. But even the language from former President Trump is one that I think advantages Putin. You know, keep what you have and stop. That doesn't work with our adversaries. Once you allow the burglars into the kitchen, the living room's right there. You know, the bedroom's back that way. They don't stop. So to give Putin a win, whether it's the Biden administration or a future Trump administration, it is going to be a mistake. Right now, we have a stalemate that will continue until we provide the Ukrainians an offensive capability. And I look at this as a, you know, how do you deal with a Cold War adversary? We have Russia with a $1.9 trillion economy. There is so much the United States could do to bankrupt Putin's war effort. And we're not putting sanctions where they need to be. We're not enforcing them. We're not enforcing them with Iran. We're not enforcing them with Turkey and China because they're buying Iranian oil. They're also buying Russian oil. We have to use our levers of power, and we're just not doing that. And Putin's taking advantage of that.
Are you surprised that once Russia started to invade Ukraine, that it looked like militarily, looked like almost a paper tiger? I mean, they didn't look well equipped. It looked like it wasn't sophisticated. What were we seeing there?
Yeah, there was so much we could learn from that initial push in. Their equipment was in disrepair. 80% of their battlefield losses when it comes to tanks were tanks that were abandoned or that broke down, not tanks that were destroyed. So the Russian motivation, the soldier, initially thought this was a training exercise. They didn't believe it was an invasion. And there were so many opportunities to deal with those convoys that were stuck in the mud, those Russian convoys that couldn't move, that ran out of gas. We saw the Russians weren't able to logistically resupply their armored personnel and their equipment, tanks and armored personnel carriers. These were targets, and had the Ukrainians had an air force, they would have been able to hit those tanks. And this war could have been, handled very differently early on than it was. The Biden administration chose not to give them that offensive capability to destroy those convoys in place. And of course, Putin always has that wild card, the nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons threat that he continues to push out there. I think the United States, and I think even China, has put enough of a red line in place to keep Putin from doing that. China is very pragmatic when it comes to Putin's use of force.
So what does that tell you? What does that tell you about Russia's military capabilities overall?
Well, their most elite units have been deplenished. They've been degraded. I was in the 82nd Airborne Division. That's America's premier, airborne force. The Russians basically had their airborne force decimated in the first 3 months of the conflict. They had aircraft shot down with paratroopers on board. Had that happened in the United States, the American population would have said, enough. We're not going to fight this way. We don't lose a company's worth of paratroopers in one aircraft being shot down. Now you have a conscript force. You have Russians that are forced into military service, that are receiving inadequate training, and are being pushed into the battlefield as cannon fodder. The elite units have been degraded. This is now a war of art, where Russia uses artillery to punish civilian sectors, rockets, and they're not taking territory. This is a great position for the U.S. to be in. We have a willing military force in Ukraine that's willing to take on the Russian military, that speaks the language, that knows the terrain, that is asking for an offensive capability to retake territory. This does not require U.S. boots on the ground. And in many ways, this is therapy for U.S. generals that lost in Iraq, gave Iraq to Iran, and lost in Afghanistan by giving Afghanistan back to the Taliban. This is what we're good at, giving a uniformed force on the ground military equipment to go after an adversary. And that's what we have in Ukraine.
In the meantime, we've given Ukraine billions of dollars.
Yes.
Without it being accounted for. What's happening? Right. Where's it going? What's going on here?
Well, like I said before, I've dealt with corruption in Iraq, and the most effective leaders were corrupt. I dealt with corruption with the Afghan forces, and the most effective leaders were corrupt. There is no rule of law in these countries. There's no rule of law in the Ukraine where, a Supreme Court or a parliament is going to say, we can't allow this money to fall into the hands of military commanders. We're seeing that happen. But what we're also seeing is an effective military command structure that's able to take on the Russians. And I know to your viewers that sounds like I'm excusing corruption. I'm just dealing with the real world. Mm-hmm. In order for Zelensky to stay in power, he needs to be able to pay people off to do very dangerous things. He needs to be able to keep people in place. It's easy to take the money and run. His commanders are staying and fighting. So that's the trade-off, unfortunately.
Is NATO effective in any of this?
NATO could be so much more effective. There's so much more equipment that NATO could be providing. You can't provide 12 tanks and expect that to change the battlefield dynamics. You have to do more. NATO could do so much more. But again, they're following the U.S. lead. And the U.S. lead at this point, it's money and it's ammunition. And the reason it's so expensive is the Ukrainians fight like the Russians. Instead of using one round per target, they'll saturate a football field to take out one tank. The U.S. military doesn't fight that way. We have precision-guided munitions that hit the tank, one round, one shot, one kill. The Ukrainians don't trust this capability and basically exhaust all of our precision-guided weapons, from Patriots to drones to MLRS or to some very sophisticated precision-guided ground or surface-to-surface missiles. They'll just saturate the battlefield with those, and then they continue to ask Congress for more. So the U.S. military-industrial complex is getting a lot of money to continue to push these munitions downrange, to the Ukrainians, but they don't have what we call in the military an economy of force philosophy, meaning one shot, one kill. Mm. They'll basically launch the whole Patriot battery system at one aircraft and then ask for more rounds. Mm. We need to tell them to be disciplined in their application of U.S. precision-guided munitions.
I mean, that just comes from war experience, right?
Absolutely, but it's the way they were trained. They're trained basically destroy a football field. And we do economy of force. One round, one target.
Let me come back to Russia just for a moment. Does Putin have another problem that's called his own economy?
He does. He, you know, Putin is able to sell gas and oil to Europe. And every effort to replace that capability with gas and oil from northern Iraq or from other countries is continually squashed by Iran, China, and Russia, and a weak Biden administration. This is a $1.9 trillion economy, the size of Texas, right? I think Texas actually outdoes the Russian economy. We have so many levers of power that we can put on Putin to basically punish his economy and punish his war effort. Well, we also have opportunities in the population. Population does not support this war. Putin doesn't trust his generals. Anytime Putin sits down at a table with his generals, he's 20 feet, 25 feet down the table. He wants to be just out of accurate small arms range, right? Because at 25 feet, it's kind of hard to hit somebody with a pistol. A lot of people think it's easy. It's kind of hard. And of course, you can't get a weapon inside the room anyway. But Putin doesn't trust his people. His people are against the war. There are so many things we could do to basically hurt his war effort. And China is continuing to fund his war effort. China's behind what Russia did in Syria. China was behind what Russia was able to do in Libya. China is now funding Putin's war effort. And the United States could do something there as well.
One other question in this region before I go on to something else, and that is, what do you think the impact of this Russian-Ukrainian war has on the rest of Europe?
Well, I think, you know, you would think they'd be more interested in it, right?
Yeah.
You know, if we look at Article 5 in NATO, our NATO allies that Putin says are next are worried because of U.S. resolve. But our traditional NATO allies don't really seem to care about it. It's almost, you know, we use this analogy often here in D.C. in the circles that I'm in. You know, Europe is like a bunch of people sitting in recliners around a swimming pool at a resort. Somebody's drowning. Instead of getting up and jumping in the pool to save that person, they wait for the Americans to show up. And we show up every time. And so they're so used to the U.S. taking the lead financially, militarily, that it gives them some comfort. And that's why, you know, former President Trump was so adamant about our NATO allies paying their fair share, what they agreed to, and doing more. This is in their backyard. We need to see more. We're not seeing that. And then it doesn't help when Germany is so dependent on Russian oil and gas that they're compromised in a way. Mm. But they don't want to do as much as they should. So, you know, we're ahead of an election year, and our adversaries see this as a permissive environment. It's a military term, meaning they can do everything they can. They can go and get all they want ahead of a U.S. election, because this Biden administration has demonstrated time and time again, you know, when you fail to the Taliban, when you lose Afghanistan to the Taliban, when you fail with Iran, how are you going to take on Russia and China?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Gosh, so complicated. Do you think if former President Trump was reelected that his policy and approach to Ukraine would be different this time?
I don't know, because I keep hearing, you know, I could settle this within 24 hours. Well, that means giving Putin a win. And if Putin is able to hold on to the Donbass region and the Luhansk region, it's like letting burglars into your house and saying, just stay in the kitchen and don't go in the living room, don't go in the bedroom.
Yeah.
Putin's going to go in. And I think this would be, you know, if Trump really wants to be serious about Ukraine, it's basically the threat of, hey, we're going to give the Ukrainians an offensive capability. We're going to give them U.S. aircraft. We're going to give them U.S. missiles that can actually hit inside of Russia. We're going to put our special ops advisors on the ground to deal with that economy of force issue, to train them on how to use precision-guided weapons and how to trust the technology instead of saturating the battlefield with weapons. There are so many things you can do. And Trump should say, day one, all the sanctions are going back in place on Iran, on China, and Russia to basically, you know, punish their economies to where they cannot sustain these operations.
Isn't that our biggest arsenal, piece of arsenal? Sanctions?
Well, it is, but if you hear what our enemies are doing, they're looking for bypass mechanisms, right?
Yeah.
So, and we're allowing that to happen. So when we hear that the Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians are trying to get away from the U.S. dollar and move towards, you know, digital currencies and antiquities and you know, other forms of, you know, of cash, right?
Right, right.
It takes away our ability to punish them with sanctions. So once you lose that ability to use the U.S. economy as leverage, what's left?
Kinetic. Okay. All right, a light just went on in my head. Good. All right, let me take a quick break. So honored to have with us Michael Bregent. You can go to his website. He's part of the, he's a senior fellow there at the Hudson Institute. You go to hudson.org. There's a picture of the landing page. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back.
We'll be back to this week's interview in just a few seconds. In the meantime, we want to let you know that you can watch this interview, plus many more exclusive interviews that happen this week on the Dove's Daily TV and radio show by visiting our website, thedove.us. And while you're there, sign up for our free daily devotional, The Word for You Today. 3 months of daily readings that will connect you with God's Word. Now, back to the show.
Okay, welcome back. And so honored to have with us today Michael Bregent. He's a former intelligence officer and current senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. Michael is so experienced in all of this. You can go to hudson.org. That's the website. So much to talk about. Michael, thank you for your time again. I want to swing your attention over to the Middle East, the three H's, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Houthis.
Right.
What's your 30,000-foot view is going on over there?
Well, Iran's strategy is winning. You know, the Hamas is an Iranian proxy. The Houthis are an Iranian proxy. And Hezbollah is Iran's premier proxy. And they are winning. The United States could hurt the Houthis now and Iran now by taking out two intelligence collection platforms in the Red Sea, the Saviz, S-A-V-I-Z, and the Behshad, B-E-H-S-H-A-D. These are two IRGC Navy collection platforms that are floating there, basically providing the targeting information to the Houthis to hit these vessels that are going to Israel to provide, you know, commerce. You know, they're threatening commerce in the Red Sea, and we continue to use million-dollar munitions to take out drones, to take out missiles and rockets from the Houthis instead of actually killing the archer on the ground, and taking out these two intelligence platforms that are designated, that are legitimate military targets, and for some reason the Biden administration won't do that.
You have any idea why?
This administration is so afraid to do anything that hurts Iran. I don't know why that is. If Al-Qaeda had killed 30 Americans on October 7th, if Al-Qaeda had 8 American hostages and their leaders were hanging out in luxury hotels in Doha, Qatar, we would have taken them out. But because they are tied to Iran, this administration is hesitant to do so. You know, President Trump took out Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, two designated terrorists in Iraq, and it knocked Iran on its heels, much like Ronald Reagan did with Operation Praying Mantis in 1988, when he decimated half of Iran's navy. This administration believes, for some reason, that they can negotiate with Iran. And Iran has benefited from this relationship. $6 billion in a Qatari bank for 5 hostages, basically placing the bounty for an American hostage at $1 billion. We don't know how many millions, or even if it was close to $1 billion per head for the two American hostages that Hamas released early on. And we don't even have a proof of life for the remaining U.S. hostages. So this administration, how do you have designated terrorists? So Hamas is a designated terrorist organization. How do you have its leaders in Qatar? Why are they not targets? And now, because they think the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, is going to target them in Qatar, they're moving to Turkey, a U.S. NATO ally. And again, why are designated terrorists, why do they feel safe in Turkey, a U.S. NATO ally? If they were al-Qaeda, they'd be targeted. If they were ISIS, they'd be targeted. But because they're tied to Iran, this administration is afraid to do something. And that is baffling to our allies in the Middle East. And it's an insult to veterans and active duty military that are being targets, that have been targets of Iranian proxies, basically since the Biden administration took office.
Staggering. Absolutely staggering. In the meantime, you know, there's an old saying, actions speak louder than words. And the president is saying, well, we have Israel's back, at the same time putting every means pressure on Israel to surrender. Where is this going?
Well, you know, you have to take comfort in Benjamin Netanyahu's words. They're going to go into Rafah, and they're going to defeat Hamas. They're providing a humanitarian corridor to get the Palestinians to where the aid is. And at no time has this administration said that Hamas should release all the hostages before any negotiations take place. At no time has this administration said that Hamas should give up, should give themselves up. This administration continues to act like 30 Americans weren't killed on October 7th. They continue to act like Hamas does not have U.S. hostages. We don't see their names on the chyrons of our news media. We don't know their names. We don't know the names of the hostages or whether they're even alive in Gaza. And we don't have a countdown. You know, we should have a countdown anytime there are U.S. hostages. So where do I see this going? The Biden administration is so worried about holdouts in Minneapolis and Michigan that they're willing to compromise a U.S. ally in its fight against a terrorist organization. And that, to me, is pathetic.
I'm just staggered by it. It seems like the two-state solution has to be right here in the United States, those two states you just mentioned.
Right.
I'm staggered over this. I mean, I don't know how else to express myself here, Michael, other than it appears to be we're in favor of sheer evil. We're siding with evil here. Something spiritually is wrong.
Weakness always sides or advantages evil. Anytime you're weak, adversaries take advantage of that. This administration can't even call Hamas a terrorist organization. I think what President Biden had to correct himself when he called them the opposition. This is a terrorist organization. And there are people inside of our government that will not condemn Hamas. Being anti-Israel has become fashionable. You know, Qatar, this country, that not only funds Hamas, they're also funding these violent protests in the United States. But more importantly, they're quieting dissent in Washington, D.C. They've put so much money into U.S. think tanks. I know pro-Israel experts in these think tanks that have been quieted because they're worried about getting fired and not being able to pay the mortgage. There are politicians that continue to praise Qatar. And one of those politicians, for your audience should know, is Lindsey Graham. Qatar has put so much economic stimulus into South Carolina that you can actually track the economic stimulus, and within a week or two, Lindsey Graham will come out and praise Qatar's role in all of this. Remember, Qatar funds Hamas. Qatar's journalists from Al Jazeera were embedded with Hamas on October 7th. 2 days later, there are anti-Israel protests funded by Hamas funded by Qatar in the United States. This is not an ally. Qatar is not an ally. It is an enemy. It is the Hotel Continental in the John Wick series. It is the bar in Star Wars. And because they host a U.S. base, they think somehow they can fund terrorism. And so Qatar needs to be called out for this. And the politicians that support Qatar, to include Lindsey Graham, should be called out on this. Remember, Qatar funded that intelligence operation to get dirt on Senator Cotton, Senator Rubio, and Senator Cruz, because they wanted to designate the Muslim Brotherhood, which is another group that Qatar funds. And Hamas is from the Muslim Brotherhood. So we can't ever defeat terrorism when we're weak, right? Our adversaries take advantage of that. But when we also have allies like Qatar, how do you defeat terrorist organizations when this ally that pays for high-end shopping centers in Washington, D.C., puts so much money into think tanks and universities, puts economic stimulus into key congressional and Senate districts in order to gain the praise of those politicians? How do you win when you allow that to happen?
How do you sleep at night? Or do you?
I do. Yeah, I do sleep at night, right? You know, you hug your family tighter. You know, you're thankful for what you have. And you try to be a solution-based analyst.
Yeah.
So when I say this, you know, I hope people listen. And I know that when I say things in D.C., people listen, because a lot of the things I warn about don't happen. And I like to think that that's a result of my analysis. And I also lay a path. I lay out the indicators of the most dangerous course of action. And if the right people see that, then they can stop it. They can mitigate it. And so I'm warning about this floating bridge in Gaza. I'm calling it an Abbey Gate scenario. And to your viewers, Abbey Gate, of course, in Afghanistan is where we lost those 13 Marines. Right. When the Biden administration, the Austin Pentagon, and the General Milley operation, which was, you know, I've served with all of these generals when I was in the 82nd. And the 101st Airborne Divisions. And to allow our soldiers to be attacked, our Marines to be attacked by a suicide bomber and killed, we're looking at that again with this floating bridge. This is an Abbey Gate scenario. And the DOD spokesperson today, or I think yesterday, said, what about Hamas? Do you view them as a threat? And he said, well, if Hamas cares as much about the Palestinian people as they say they do, they won't attack us and they'll allow the aid in.
Yeah.
Hope is not a strategy. Hope is for your family and your football team, not for Hamas.
So this floating port off the Mediterranean there on the coast of Gaza that was proposed in the State of the Union address by President Biden, will Netanyahu allow this? And then he goes on to say no American boots will be on the ground.
It's so much. It just screams of distrust between Israel and the United States, right?
Right.
There are already corridors to get humanitarian aid in. And it just seems like, I don't know if your viewers are familiar with the term, the good idea fairy. Well, the good idea fairy is somebody sitting around a table that says, hey, why don't we have a floating humanitarian land bridge where we can bring aid in? And if I was around that table, I'd say, you got to be kidding me. You're basically setting up a target for U.S. military. And the people building that bridge and the people that will be manning that bridge are not combat arms soldiers. They will be logisticians. They'll be engineers, all uniformed. And they'll be a target for Hamas. They'll be a target for Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And this administration will probably excuse it and say, it wasn't Hamas, it wasn't Palestinian Islamic Jihad, it was ISIS, just like they did in Afghanistan. The Taliban let that suicide bomber in. The Haqqani Network let that suicide bomber in. And remember, at the time, this administration called the Taliban partners on the ground. And that Pentagon spokesperson, when he talked about Hamas, you could almost hear our partners on the ground. And that, to me, is dangerous. And it is a foolish notion to think that we can somehow put this in place and then hope that Hamas doesn't attack. Because we hope they're going to be good when it comes to humanitarian aid. And it makes no sense.
Michael, you're fascinating. Can we get you back? I know your time is valuable, but
anytime. Thanks for having me, and I hope it's made sense.
Yeah, it does. And God bless you for being there and staying on the post. Let me share to our viewers and listeners, check out Michael's website. He's a senior fellow there at the Hudson Institute. You can go to hudson.org. There's a picture of the landing page. Gosh, I just added you.
Yeah, go to experts up there, type my name in, and you'll see what I'm doing. I'm also on Twitter, and, you know, anytime I can you know, tell decision makers what they need to hear and not what they want to hear, I feel it's a good day.
Yeah, I just added you to my prayer list. Thank you, Michael.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, God bless.
Thank you for listening to this week's Focus Today podcast. Remember, you can visit our website to check out all the interviews we did this week on our daily Focus Today TV show at thedove.us. And if you like this podcast, please take a moment to rate us and share it with your friends.